of the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon Legislature. It's Monday, April 23rd. And coming up first, we're going to finish our public hearing from Friday on House Bill 2621. And then we will move into a work session on House Bill 2735 after that.
It's not even on here. Oh, it is.
Okay. We're also going to be carrying over House Bill 3186, House Bill 3081, and House Bill 2002 until Tuesday at 6 p.m. If you're here for those, we're not going to hear those today, or there will be no work session on those today. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2621. And I'm going to go from Friday's sign-up sheet. We had Gene Eng, Brian DeLashmet, and Jim Craven. Colleagues, if you remember House Bill 2621. Thank you, gentlemen, for your patience from last Friday. Introduce yourselves for the record, please.
Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. AEA is a national trade association that represents companies who manufacture electronic equipment, who write software, and who are involved in various parts of the Internet. To cut to the chase, we're opposing the proposed amendments to this bill for a very simple reason. A number of my companies are in the Internet communications part of the world called VoIP, V-O-I-P, Voice Over Internet Protocol. Some of you may have toyed with this technology at home. It's when you can use your computer to talk to somebody rather than a phone or a cell phone. And in the definition of functionally equivalent telecommunications, which is, you've already heard some of that debate from the PUC commissioner and others, that this bill would propose to open the regulatory door to certain functionally equivalent communication services. We believe that that definition would bring in voice over IP. The inherent difficulty of doing that, if any of you have played around with the technology, is that voice over IP is really a system of a computer talking to a computer rather than a landline or even a cell phone talking to another landline or cell phone. And essentially, your computer, what's called, every computer has a unique address called an IP address. And so voice over Internet is IP address speaking to an IP address generally, which can be done from anywhere. You can take your laptop around this country and make calls on a provider like Skype from your computer to another computer, and the Internet doesn't really care where you are. It just recognizes that it's a computer. The Federal Communication Commission to date, the federal FCC, has said that VoIP regulation is out of bounds to state legislators. One state, Minnesota, that attempted to open regulation to VoIP, that case was litigated, and they were overturned by the Eighth Circuit Court of Federal Appeals. So we believe that voice over Internet protocol is really not open to your regulation. We believe this bill would attempt to do that. We believe that the state is on thin ice in making that attempt and could possibly result in costly litigation down the road. So on behalf of AEA, we oppose the proposed amendments that would bring voice over IP under the regulatory authority of the Public Utility Commission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gene Eng, and I'm Vice President, Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for Verizon in Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about this very important issue. And let me start by saying that Verizon is the second largest wireline provider in the state, and we strongly oppose this bill because it will impose expansive new regulation on broadband-enabled services and the fully competitive wireless market. As Mr. Valdez indicated last Wednesday, you might remember, we've invested over $170 million in the last 2 years here in Oregon in an all-fiber network. And this has created hundreds of brand-new family-wage union jobs, and we're poised to begin providing new and innovative services to Oregonians. And we think this bill is going to be a big step backwards. It will expand regulation under the guise of protecting consumers. Don't be fooled by the soft language that appears in Section 11 of the amended bill, which talks about assisting Oregon customers in resolving their complaints. It goes far beyond that. The provision goes on to authorize the PUC to use the complaint investigation and hearing procedures set forth in ORS 756-500 to 756-610. This opens the door for expansive regulation by allowing the PUC to open a full-blown regulatory proceeding on its own initiative on almost any issue and to investigate it using subpoenas, formal hearings, and the issuance of a binding order. And this isn't just Chicken Little. You heard that term the other day. It's not Chicken Little saying that the sky is falling. And I have an opinion from former Attorney General Brown, which I'll share with you, which should be distributed, which outlines just how expansive this regulation of competitive services and new services really is. And let me just quote you a couple of sentences. Much of the new regulatory authority granted by the PUC to the PUC by HB 2621-1 is explicitly set forth in sections 11, 12, and 13 of the proposed amendment. However, I have concluded that the actual regulatory authority would be much more extensive than the plain language of section 7, 11, 12, and 13 would suggest. And then that begs the question, is this really necessary? And as you heard on Friday, The current process works well. Practically every service provider has been willing to cooperate with the PUC in order to best serve Oregon consumers. And the Commission's very own report, The Status of Competition and Regulation in the Telecommunications Industry, which was just issued in January of this year, shows that. The report shows that the number of contacts, and I want to be clear on this when I say contacts, according to the language in the report, these are inquiries which may or may not contain an element of complaint. And the numbers show that these contacts have been decreasing. In 2004, they're running at the level of about 1,700. And they decreased to 653 in 2006, while the number of subscribers, wireless subscribers, has increased to over 2.4 million. And you add on top of that a powerful consumer protection tool that already exists in the Attorney General's Office of Consumer Protection, which is able to open and pursue an action against any bad actor that has demonstrated a pattern of abusing Oregon customers. And therefore, we think that adopting the amendments to HB 2621 would take Oregon in the exact opposite direction of at least seven other states that have taken a proactive deregulatory approach to incenting companies to invest and to accelerate the deployment of next-generation broadband infrastructure in their communities. And so for that reason and for those reasons, we would urge you to reject these amendments. Thank you.
For the record, Brian DeLashman here today representing Sprint Nextel. I've submitted written testimony with some additional documents. One of the things that I was going to cover was the letter from the Attorney James Brown, former Attorney General. Mr. Eng did read the first sentence or two of that, but in my testimony, I've actually outlined that paragraph. And if you read down a little further, Because of the context and existing and overarching statutory framework enacted in House Bill 2621-1 would also provide the PUC with authority to promulgate administrative rules, conduct investigations, initiate administrative litigation, and impose civil penalties on wireless providers in the amount as high as $10,000. I think that's pretty far beyond what we've heard, which is this is an informal process and we don't issue subpoenas and so forth. So I wanted to point that out. I think that's the main thrust of this entire letter. The second thing that Mr. Ng had pointed out was, and I know we've talked to many of you and showed you the complaint numbers over the last couple of years, with the number of units or wireless units, 2.4 going like this, at the same time, if you were to take a graph of those units going like this, you will see complaints going like this. Why is that happening? There's something happening out there that is causing that to happen. One is competition. The second is the informal process that we are all talking about here. In those rare occasions where there is an inquiry or a legitimate complaint, is resolving the issue. So numbers going like this, complaints going like this, and as Mr. Ng has indicated, the complaints are not that are listed in there are inquiries, not complaints. All those inquiries, the number of actual complaints is much smaller than that, about 10 to 15%. And of those, even using the words of the chairman of the PUC last week when he testified, he said, in nearly every case, they find that, in fact, the carrier is correct, that, in fact, it is not an issue with the carrier, that there's a problem. So, and again, we have mentioned this to many of you, but the inquiries can be as simple as, I don't know how to read a line 3 of my bill. Or my carrier told me it was going to cost me $39.95 a month, and now the bill is $42. Why is that? Well, then when it's explained that there's an FCC charge on it, there's some other taxes on it, that's what, in fact, the final bill is. And once that, in fact, is run through, they understand that, then, in fact, they go away. Maybe not fully happy, but it's not a real complaint. The next thing that I'd like to touch on very briefly is that we've heard many times these people have no place to go. Well, you also heard that there's a process in place. And it's working very well. In fact, the chairman said it works very well. So let me walk through just real quick in my testimony. What I attempted to do is say, okay, if I was consumer A out there and I had an issue, what would I do? Well, you will have a page that looks similar to this. So what I did is we've told you that the FCC has regulatory authority over wireless. So I Googled FCC. And so what comes up, of course, is the Federal Communications Commission homepage. You click on that, and then you get the next page, which if you run down the side, and it's page 203 on here, if you run down the side, Consumer Center, and it talks about filing complaints about halfway down there. So you click on that, and the very next page is filing a complaint with the FCC is easy. Let's try that one more time.
Yeah. Those of you in the audience, if you would please turn off your cell phones. They cause feedback and interruptions. I appreciate that. If you could check your phones and turn them off. Thank you.
So the third click, so it's taking you a Google to FCC. You've got the home page. You click on the home page, and it gives you a menu. You go down that, click on complaints, and the next page is filing a complaint with the FCC is easy. So if you follow that page down, in fact, it does have, under each one of those, emails, phones, and faxes. It gives you the access to either email them or call them to deal with an issue. They have people on duty 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to ask questions, or you can contact them electronically. So given that, I said, okay, FCC has some control. Let's go to the PUC. And I did the same thing. I did Oregon PUC. State of Oregon Public Utilities Commission pops up. The very next page, the home page, complaint form. It's already there. They have the ability to do this already. People already utilize it. And then I said, okay, so if somebody doesn't have a computer, what do they do? Well, Everybody recognize what this is? We still have some of these around. And I started thumbing through it, and I went to about 30 pages in, and it says consumer tips. And you go to consumer tips, and on the first page it says resolving disputes. And in fact, there is a telephone number there for the Public Utility Commission's Consumer Services Division available to help you. And it's a toll-free number. I said, okay, so they can do that. If you don't happen to find it in here, go to the next opportunity, State of Oregon. You look under the State of Oregon, under the Public Utility Commission. And in fact, the Public Utility Commission office has a number of numbers, including a complaint number, a consumer services number. So no one in this process can say that there isn't already a process. It works, and people can use the system by using either email or by calling and getting the response that they need. And with that, I'll close.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple. Mr. Craven, assuming that the Eighth Circuit opinion is correct and the state can't regulate VoIP, does the FCC have consumer protections for VoIP as well as for wireless?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I am not positive. I will do some homework on that. I don't want to give you a definitive answer on that at this time. It is a very emerging nation of technology, so I'm not sure is my answer, and I will do some homework.
And my question for Mr. Eng and Mr. DeLashmet, either one of you, what other states, if any, have consumer protection provisions similar to what's in this bill for wireless customers?
I don't know the answer to that specifically. You know, that would be consistent with what's being proposed there. I mean, that's something we can look into and get back to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, it's my understanding that no other states have a similar provision of putting this kind of regulation in the PUC. As you heard from the chairman of the PUC last week, there are some other schemes. In fact, we have another scheme, which is the Attorney General currently has some jurisdiction under the unfair trade practices to deal with this, and with the agreement voluntary compliance, they have the authority to do that now. You also heard that only three of the nine that wireless carriers in the state of Oregon have signed on to that. That does not, however, mean that the other six, in fact, don't come underneath the unfair trade practices first, or that the PUC, under the voluntary system they have now, are not, in fact, a party to the complaints and the resolution of those complaints.
And one more follow-up, please, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. For wireless customers who, for example, buy their phone in Oregon and then they go somewhere else, for example, off to college or to take a job somewhere else, but they keep their phone, if this passes, then do they have to make a complaint here? And conversely, if somebody moves here from another state, keeping their phone that they got in another state, can they? Will they then have to go back to their old state to complain? How does that work with people who travel around?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonabici, I'm glad you asked that question. Actually, last Wednesday, when the CTIA folks were here, and I believe somebody else testified, in the cases where somebody moves into another location, the ability to relocate and break a contract is pretty much an automatic. People do that. They understand that there's no reason to have a cell phone that has a Portland address or Portland number when you're going to live in Seattle or someplace else. So, in fact, they do go through that process, and the cell phone companies let them out of that contract. Where they would actually go to complain if that didn't happen, I would assume you'd start where your base contract was, the state in which your base contract was originated. The second piece to that is, in going through, and sometimes I find helpful information in Money Magazine, and it just happened this month in Money Magazine, it says three ways to drop a cell phone contract. And I was not aware of this, but there are resellers, or it's kind of like a eBay for linking folks up that, in fact, want to get out of the contract. Either they're moving, or, in fact, they want a different carrier. And they list on one of those resellers, and it's a pretty nominal fee, and they match up somebody to take over your contract so that, in fact, you're excused from your contract. And the cost was $19.99. to list on one. It was $9.95 on one. It was $14.99 on the other. And they found, they rated the three, and I'd be happy to share this information. But in a very short period of time, a day or two, they had people that were willing to take your contract over. They were just trying to link folks up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For a rural county like the one I represent, Yamhill County, we have many businesses that sell products and services outside of the local calling area. So to them, to my people, competitive pricing is very important. What would they do if this bill passed? I mean, how would they compete in their businesses, because they're going to have substantial problems getting phone service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think the best way to answer that is with this bill, and I am assuming you're talking about the deregulatory side. What you'll see happen is the pricing and availability will be dictated by the market. It will be dictated by what the market will bear and what the market's willing to provide. So.
Just a last
one more.
Yes, I'm just wondering, of course I don't know this, but I recall that when DSL came in, we had a similar situation as this, where there was a major company that sought to reduce competition. And could you just tell me what would be the total purpose of decreasing competition other than a larger market share? Other than that, what other benefit is it? And that's that, of course, for the company.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, when you say decreasing competition, do you mean like decreasing prices?
No, I mean when you have fewer companies that can compete, what benefit would that be for the consumer?
Representative Nelson, Mr. Chair, I think, I mean, I'm just going to answer it just from a purely theoretical standpoint. If you have less providers in the marketplace, I think what that would mean is less consumer choice and probably less supply, which then, you know, would then, depending upon, you know, the market, prices would fluctuate according to that.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next up, I'd like to have Mike Dewey and Andrea Fogg.
Thanks, Mike. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. While the League is neutral on the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2621 at this time, I want to talk about some issues today that are important to cities, and I have 3 points really to cover. First of all, the issue of telecommunications deregulation is very complex, and we want to ensure that there is no unintended consequences for local authority, local regulations, or state statutes as they relate to the relationship between cities and telecommunications providers. And I do thank Chairman Beyer Friday for putting that comment on the record during his testimony. Our second point is that we have potential concerns both from a consumer perspective and also from an economic development perspective. And this comes from the fact that we've heard reports that there could be increased costs under the deregulation portion of the bill. And if that would occur, it could have significant consequences not only for cities as consumers, but our ability to retain business and industry economic development. And finally, from a consumer perspective, a citizen perspective, really, we want to make sure that this is not confusing for them. The PUC has said that they're going to do some extensive education. That's very important because particularly for those citizens that want that basic local exchange service and that landline, that the bills is somewhat confusing in terms of what their options are. And those could be the folks with the least ability to pay. So we want to make sure that that education effort happens. And then my final point is really a technical one. There are a couple of sections in the bill with definitions that we think would need to be better defined through rulemaking before the bill could be implemented. And that, just to put it on the record, in Section 2.3, functionally equivalent or substitutable service, and in Section 2.1, alternate provider. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify and would answer any questions that you have. And I'd also, Mr. Chair, like to thank PUC Commissioner Lee Beyer and his staff for really working through these concerns and spending a lot of time with us with this very comprehensive amendment.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I've been representing the cable telecom industry since 1975, and I would agree with Ms. Fogg regarding the, if you will, the complexity of the issues as you move into a, if you will, a telecom environment with voice over internet and the like. Amy Tyson, albeit brief, last Wednesday from Ben Broadband, who's the CEO, spoke about the investments they've made, and I would hope you'd have the opportunity to take a look at that testimony because I'm not going to take a lot of time. But with regard to the PUC, we have a lot of respect for the PUC. But nonetheless, there may be another PUC at some point in time. And with regard to the parameters in the area of consumer protection, they may change. I do have a copy of Mr. Brown's letter. And with regard to the powers that they have, we all agree they have those powers. How they use those, we do not know. But I do know that at some point in time, there will be changes at the PUC. So we have to reflect on that. With regard to the bill that's come forward, Mr. DiLorenzo had an interesting quote about the menu and so forth in the table. I would just say some have portrayed this as a compromise. We were not at the table having this discussion. Maybe we weren't expected to be, but nonetheless, there are two areas that we would voice some concern. Mr. Craven talked about the VoIP side, reflecting on the Eighth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals decision. That's not binding for where we are, but nonetheless, taking a look at it, it's a pretty far-reaching opinion. Others are moving in that direction with regard to where Congress is and the FCC on VoIP. I need to say there are a lot of different flavors of VoIP. Mr. Craven talked about one. Our networks are in kernel, So as we talk about digital voice service, they're over our internal networks, but nonetheless, to make a call, if it's Comcast, Charter, or Ben Broadband, for example, you still have to have interconnection agreements. And I know the business community, Tracer, talked about that and concerns that there might be with regards to some pricing that might increase. So we are concerned about VoIP. I think you have some legal issues. We can raise those at any time. We can find lawyers on both sides of those kinds of issues, but I'm not sure if you want to have necessarily that litigated as if this bill goes forward. Also, I do want to talk just briefly, and you have the studies about competition. I'm not going to go into that, just to say that we believe the cable telecom companies are well-positioned to provide competition in the business or the commercial sector, primarily small and medium-sized businesses. We're doing well, obviously, in the video side. We're doing well on the high-speed data side. We're doing well on the voice side, and it only makes sense to take a look at smaller, medium-sized businesses. With regard to the cable industry, when there was not competition, there was rate regulation, and the cities basically did that under the franchise agreement. Once there was competition, the FCC moved in a different direction. And so I say to you, you need to take a look at the public policy as to where competition is, what might happen. We're, if you will, the regulatory in nature. We want to get there as quickly as we can. But I do think there needs to be some sort of, if you will, effective competition test in the marketplace to ensure that rates do not go up. I don't know if they will or will not, but we do have price caps requests now, and clearly they can lower rates. I'm not sure whether or not they are at the cap because there are different caps. But nonetheless, that's a public policy issue that you need to have, and you need to think through that. Finally, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for having a number of hearings on this issue. Again, it's complicated for me, and you have so many other things to think about and time, so we do appreciate having, if you will, the advantage to fully discuss this before that before this committee. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions you have in your care when you want me to.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee of these? Thanks. Thank you very much. I'd like to call up Lee Beyer. And any support staff you want to bring with you, I suppose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, you've heard the testimony that we have just finished up from last Friday. And I was wondering if you had any additional comments or things that came up that you would like to address before the committee asks you some questions.
Okay. I'd let me hit a couple of points. One, I think you start off with what in terms of...
I did identify you, but if you could do it for
yourself. I thought I had. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Lee Beyer, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Excuse me. Voice is a little better today than it was on Friday, but still.
Did you bring your water? That's what we're on.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. We have some. If you need.
One of the big questions that you heard a lot about is this new regulatory authority, and I want to be real clear on that. The only thing this bill does is ask wireless and similar functionally equivalent companies to register with the commission. Why? So we know who's selling service there. If somebody calls up one of their customers and asks for help. And part of that registration, which, by the way, is at no cost to them, we ask them to give us the name of a staff person or names of staff people, a few, that we can work with if we get a complaint. And we ask them, as part of that, when they make the final decision, to let us know what that is so we can go back and talk to the customers. One, that's one thing. The other thing we ask them to do is we ask them to assist us biannually as we meet your requirement to provide you with a competitive report. You ask us to say, tell us the mandate of the commission is to provide you biannually with a report on the state of competition in the state. Currently, we have a hard time getting that information, frankly, from the non-regulated industry, and we just wanted to have to be able to fulfill your request to us to have us do that. That's all. There's no more there. The site that you heard, and apparently former Attorney General Brown, is our standard language on how do you do a formal complaint. It's a process that's lined out there for the protection of both industry participants and customers. Last year, we did a total of 12 formal complaints. 12 formal complaints were filed. All but four of those were resolved before they ever got into any hearing process. Most of that is done over the telephone, but it is restricted to resolving the customer complaint. What kind of complaints do we get? Primarily, we get complaints about the monthly bill. Someone gets a bill and they said, gee, there seems to be a lot more minutes charged or more things in this bill than we think are right under our agreement with the company. Can we resolve that? And I think I told you last time that we had about 1,700. That's the stack. There's about 10 to a page. And that's the actual complaints, and almost all of them we've gone through. The total amount of that in that period of time resulted in not a lot of money, but we helped the customer recover about $135,000. Not a huge amount of money, but if it's your $5 or $20 or $100, it's a lot to you. And I think that's important for Oregonians to know that they can come to their government in some place and get some assistance. I'll be very honest with you. A good percentage of the time, they're wrong. And one other thing I should tell you is that every one of those complaints, they went to the company first. We will not deal with a complaint. Our first question is, have you talked to the company? And if they haven't, we help them get to the company. Make sure they know how to get there and do that. And say, if you don't get an answer that you're satisfied with, give us a call back and we'll see what we can do for you. That's just the process. We deal very informally. We're not into dealing the formal process. And, in fact, if that was the obstacle to keep the bill going forward, we'd work with you and change that. because that's not what we're after here. We just want to help customers resolve their issues, and they're out there. I don't know. I can tell you the formal statistics. I said it's about 1,700 the last couple of years on wireless alone. I can tell you that whenever I go to a social event and you get the standard question, what do you do? And I tell them what I do. Everybody's got their story that they're going to show. Mainly it's because most of these things are small. A lot of people don't call and complain about it. They're out there. It's just they don't know where to call. Mr. DeLashman obviously did a lot more research. Apparently he went through that website faster than I've ever been able to do, and even found it at the FCC. It's tough. So anyway, that's on that side. Not a lot of new regulation here. Not a lot. In fact, I would say there's none. The other side of this is the so-called deregulation, and I think this gets to Representative Nelson's question. What would be there if you chose to enact this bill is it doesn't change anything in terms of those particularly rural residents, their availability to get a phone call and make it. Well, I think what you're talking about is being able to make those long calls. That's called Extended Area Service or EAS. You all pay for it on your phone bill. None of that changes. And, in fact, for a person... And this is important, keep in mind, for a person who just wants a telephone, that's all they want, nothing fancy, just a telephone, that continues to be regulated until sometime in the future when this legislature chooses to deregulate it. It's currently, on average, about $12.80 a month. That is frozen if you pass this bill for an additional 3 years, and after that, the four companies that are affected by this would be able to come in and ask the commission to raise that price cap. They would have to make a case justifying why that their cost had gone up and they had to go up, but they could do that. Frankly, they can do that now. That's what the price regulation is all about. Last piece, I mean, we've heard all this stuff about how voice over the internet protocol and all this stuff is magical and different. The IP in VOIP is internet. There's internet packets, or it's
internet protocol.
It's how you send packets. Almost all of the telephone system uses that technology today. You go wire to an office, and then it goes over a fiber optic cable in a packet. It's all computerized. The old mechanical days are gone. The industry is pretty much the same. There isn't a heck of a lot of difference between one telephone instrument and another today. They're all using the same basic things. The one distinction that Mr. Craven mentioned, which is accurate, is the mobile technology, computer-to-computer, the Eighth Circuit case that he was referring to, was correct. And that was, if you're going all over the place, what they're saying there is, from a state perspective, if it's moving across the lines, does that fall under state jurisdiction? It's the Interstate Commerce Clause issue. And they said in that case it doesn't. But that decision was based on people using microphones like these, talking into a computer and making a call to someone on another computer. Quite frankly, since then they've had some problems because you're not doing that anymore. The new technology, as I showed you last Friday, is you have a phone that you plug into a jack and maybe a thing, and it works the same darn way as the other ones. Nationally, as well as you, Congress, as well as state legislatures, are having problems sorting out exactly how do you deal with the changing technology. And I think that's real. And the courts are all over the place, I will tell you that. On one end, as Mr. Dewey was saying, they said that computer to computer, they can see that one is different. But when you're using a cable and going from, you know, a phone in this building to a phone over there on Willamette campus over a cable line, well, that's VOIP also, a form of VOIP, and they're saying, well, no, we think that's more like a phone question. The other problem they're having is trying to decide how to distinguish them if you give them both a phone number. That's a governmental agency that assigns phone numbers, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with that. I guess I'm rambling here, Mr. Chair, but what I'm essentially saying, as I said the other day, what you're talking about is a phone call, and all we're trying to distinguish here is that in a world that's gotten a lot more complicated since the bells broke up, and as you're adding packaging a number of other things along with the phone call, whether it's, you know, three-way calling, caller ID, or television services, I think you're going to see, with the technology increasing, a lot more confusion. You're going to see more customers thinking they've been taken advantage of and they want some place to call. All we want to do is to help them resolve that complaint on one side. The other side is, I think you're seeing on the telephone company side, you have four companies that are starting to see an incredible amount of competition in the marketplace, and they want some flexibility, not on the basic line, but on that bundling. They want to be able to respond to that, and frankly, they are losing lines. They're losing lines to the phone to the competitors, and I think they probably feel like they've got one hand tied behind their back, which is a different place for them to be coming out of a monopoly environment. But I think, in fairness, that's something the legislature ought to consider. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And I have one question. I know you have no crystal ball that you use, or at least I don't think you do. but, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, this is going to drive prices up in our rural areas. You know, how do you see that? I don't know whether they're talking about the consumer protection is going to drive up prices in the rural areas or whether deregulating the bundling by the landline companies is going to drive up prices.
Well, I guess I would say, Mr. Chair, that I've been surprised at consumers' response in general. The basic phone line, as I said, is about $12.80, and that's not going to change if this bill passes. Probably won't change if this bill doesn't pass. But while that's out there, people have been willing to buy these things and pay $29, $39, $59 a month for these. I haven't seen a lot that's driven prices down on these things, but there's competition out there. I think that if you watch the ads that are in the paper, the cable companies that are advertising now are offering their packages about $35 a month. Well, that's more than the phone company under the basic package, but, you know, I guess that's a long way around of saying that I think the marketplace is just going to be different and people are going to make choices and be confused. That's one of the things that we hope to be able to do in a very limited fashion is to try to provide more consumer education. What I'd really like to see is to have the commission be able to put on our webpage, here's what you ought to think about if you're buying a telephone service, and have a link to all the companies. So, you know, we'd say, this is the thing you ought to consider, and here's a link to all of the companies that have registered, and you can click on it and make your own decision.
Thank you. Questions from the committee of the commissioner, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Beyer, for being here again. I asked the representatives from the wireless company what other states, if any, have consumer protection provisions similar to those in 2621. Do you know which states have similar provisions?
There are about five or six, and they're all in different ways. Ones that stand out in my mind that are doing similar things. I want to be clear, Representative. I'm not sure what the legal status is with them. I can tell you who's doing something. Nebraska has an aggressive program that they're doing. I don't believe they have any statutory authority to do it, but they're working with wireless, is your question. Iowa, Minnesota's been all over the map. They've been in out of court a lot trying to regulate VoIP. Kentucky, I can get back to you on that. I don't know the specific ones offhand. There's quite a few. I know that there are about six or seven states that have legislation that's very similar to this that they're considered during this session.
Thank you. Brief follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And in those states, are they all being challenged as being preempted by the FCC?
Challenged as being preempted by the FCC? They're all being challenged by the industry. I don't know that they've been challenged. I don't think the FCC has challenged any of them, per se.
Not that the FCC is challenging them, but is somebody challenging that they should be governed by that?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, the industry, CTIA, has a very clear national policy of opposing any state intervention. In fact, they had, in the last session, there was a major national rewrite of the telecom industry, telecom legislation that didn't make it through in the end, but they had a proposal in there to essentially eliminate all state consumer protection of phone services. In fact, 41 state attorney generals signed a letter to Congress that said if you include that provision in your act, you'll take consumer protection away from the states. So they had, that was there. I mean, if you look at it another way, the assurance of voluntary compliance that has been referred to here was entered into by three companies with 33 states' attorney general Oregon being one of those. And I will tell you that you usually don't get into those situations. I mean, companies usually don't jump in front and say, volunteer, say, I want to talk to the Attorney General and see if I can sign an assurance of voluntary compliance because it's in my customer's interest.
Representative Galizio.
Chair Beyer, under the bill, could you talk a little bit about the power that the PUC would have in terms of the terms and conditions of contracts? I mean, to what extent could the PUC materially affect terms and conditions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I frankly think very limited power. I think we have more power of persuasion. What the 96 Telecom Act, and it's a federal act, said was that matters of entry and exit into the marketplace and rates are totally withheld by the federal government. States can have no impact on that at all. But it went on to say that states have the authority to deal with terms and conditions. As that latter phrase has been clarified through various court actions, it's been slimmed down. There's not a lot that you can do within that. I mean, it's a pretty narrow band of power because almost everything affects terms. But I think it primarily gets down to resolving billing issues. I think that's about as far. Would you have a different interpretation, Dave?
My name is Dave Booth. I'm the administrator of the Telecommunications Division of the PUC. Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, he's handed the ball to me, but I'm not sure I can be much more helpful. The term terms and conditions obviously doesn't include price. I mean, we can't redetermine or establish a different price than the company is charging. I suppose we could look at whether the company somehow misrepresented what the customer was going to get, promised one thing but gave them something else. But when they signed the contract, I think they really have a problem getting out of the contract. I don't think the commission could rewrite it, but a lawyer could tell me something different tomorrow. It's not very responsive, but I think it's a very limited ability to really have the customer's contract redone. We could help them work within the contract and resolve their concerns.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, if I can follow up on that, I think our success, and I will call it that, on behalf of customers, has been more in the neighborhood of moral suasion. Asking people to, you know, take care of their customers. And frankly, we've been fairly successful, and companies have been pretty responsive to that. And it's essentially, you know, I call up and as a customer, I may call and I may get the call center and nothing happens. But frankly, if my staff, if the PUC is calling, we get a different response.
Representative Gilliam, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Beyer, thank you for being here again. And thank you for your attitude for this tough bill. I appreciate when you came by my office. I appreciate the way you present. You have a very good reputation in this building, whether you're for or against this bill. And, of course, we enjoy serving with your daughter and your father over on the Senate side. But I wanted to say a couple of things about this bill because I don't like it and I don't understand why it's married together. It's been explained to me, and I, as you explain in simple terms, the simplicity of what you want. I continue to wonder why we, and someone such as yourself and the attitude and the way you approach this, why we can't get that information and that cooperation. I don't sense that's being held from you or there's a resistance on the part of the wireless community to do that. So I just don't understand why we need a potential club here. And which goes back to the whole point someone else brought up, what happens when Lee Beyer isn't here and we're stuck with this thing? So that's one part of it. And then I ask, last week when I didn't have a chance to ask you a question,
Can't you already, through your current authority, do this on the regulation side as it relates to Quest? The deregulation side, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillum, a couple of complicated questions there. I don't think you asked me why it was together, but in case you did, as I told you in your office, it's together because as a sausage mill works, that's what it took to get a bill. The other piece in terms of why do we need this, actually, to be honest with you, we're probably overreaching our authority, but I'm going to do it until you tell me I can't on behalf of Oregonians because that's who I work for. It would be better, and frankly, I feel rather strongly, both in my current job and as a former legislator, that Congress is, they've limited the state's rights, but they've allowed you some role, and I think you ought to maintain on behalf of Oregon's whatever authority Congress will let you keep. That's one piece of it. The other piece, in terms of the authority, it's possible. As I believe Mr. DiLorenzo pointed out the other day, we just did a case, well, it's about a little over a year ago, where Quest came in and asked for deregulation, and we said no. Why did we say no? Under the law, the commission can only make a decision based on the evidence that's presented into the marketplace. The evidence on competition that we had was fairly limited. Why was it limited? It's because the competitors did not provide us any information for obvious reasons. It's not in their best interest to do that. Based on the information we had, legally, there was no other place we could go but say no. And you've got the case, you can read it, and I think it's pretty well outlined in there. Now, intuitively, what I know about the marketplace, I think it's different than that, but I don't have the evidence. I hope that's responsive to your comments.
It's helpful.
Question, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I was still thinking of what Gillum said when I started the buyer issue, like the Daryl and there. Lee, would it be possible that you could get an attorney's interpretation of this federal court decision before we have to vote on this issue?
Which decision?
The one that says there's a new federal court decision affirming exclusive federal regulatory jurisdiction over VOIP services in direct contradiction to Senate Bill 969 and amendments in this bill. It says the ruling makes clear that these bills, if enacted, would be in direct violation of federal rules by extending Oregon regulations to Internet communications. So wouldn't it be possible that we could do that before we go through all the costly, timely putting this in process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'd be certainly happy to get our Attorney General to respond to that. In fact, I don't want to put him on the spot. I'd rather let him respond to you. I've read that opinion, and it is very narrow. I would not come to the same conclusion, and I would say again what that decision was directed towards was, I believe that was the New York State one. Whichever state it was, I think it was New York. They were trying to regulate the operation of voice over the Internet protocol programs, and that's clear to me, and in fact they wanted to deal with entry. They were trying to deal with Skype and a couple others, the entry, and that clearly is in violation of federal law. That's been pretty clear. That's not what 2621 deals with. What 2621 deals with, essentially putting in very simple terms, it's more contract. It says if you sell a service and you're not delivering the service, then we can attempt to intervene on the customer's behalf. It's not telling them how they can operate the system or whether they can come into the state or not. We can't do that. That's real clear. But if you'd like, I could get more clarity for you.
Thank you, Commissioner, for coming forward and giving us a chance to ask you some questions. And
we have time for one more.
Sure. One more question, Representative Gillum.
Thank you, Mr.
As long
Chair.
As it's an easy one.
Better be a
okay.
good one.
That's great.
you described the current process for particularly the wireless customers and their complaints as working fairly well, and I want to clarify something you said about numbers of complaints, because we heard some testimony, not from you, several weeks ago, and I think there was some confusion about the number of complaints that were coming in. When you say roughly 1,700, I don't know if that was annual, and is that combination of inquiry and complaint, or is there some other way that you categorize those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, that's essentially people coming in. They generally don't call up and say, gee, you know, I've been thinking about buying a wireless phone, where should I go? Although some do, actually. Not a lot of that. Usually, you got to be motivated to search out us and find a way to get there. Our average, the numbers were higher, the 1,700 number, it's a little less than that, actually, was over a two-year period. It was 2005 and 2006. That two-year period that I'm talking about, that's what these are. But I went back and looked at what our tracking is, and it pretty much is about 500 a quarter. That's what it works out to be. That's what it was for the first quarter of this year. And that's total together. And again, I want to emphasize that a lot of those people who call up and have a complaint, when we work through it, the company's right. But there's value in that, because they feel better once they have somebody independent of the company saying, well, that actually is what you signed up for. So there's value in that. And mostly it's over the telephone, so it's not a big deal. There was a higher number in 2005 than there is now. That was largely generated by a merger of AT&T and Singular, when there was lots of people that were unhappy because their service was changed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2621. And next up, I'm going to have a work session on House Bill 2735. And I was hoping, do we have legislative counsel in the room? To go through the amendments. We do have him in the room. Legislative counsel on House Bill 2735, we're in work session. Was hoping you could give us a brief summary of. We have dash one and dash two amendments, I believe. Okay, and before we get started with legislative counsel, committee administrator Steve Dixon.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Just for the members' information, there is a letter from Representative Crummell and letters of support from the mayor of Newburgh, Sherwood, and Gladstone. And the Oregon Mayor's Association has taken a neutral position, as has the mayor of King City. I just wanted to bring that to the members' attention.
Thank you. Taylor, is there something we can supply you?
I was looking for a copy of the dash.
Did you find one?
No, I haven't.
Well, I think
so this may be very interesting testimony.
I I'm sure we can drum one up for you real quick.
Dash one.
We usually don't walk around with extra copies, as you know, because you make them so thick.
I'm moving there.
Since we can't move it, we don't have it. I can't believe that. I always have surplus.
Is John Van Landingham in the office? Would you like to come forward as well, please? So, we have already walked through the dash one with Mr. Van Landingham at some point previous to this. I don't know if Mr. Van Landingham wishes to start out by talking about the dash one specifically, or
Mr. Chair, I have a two-page memo which describes in detail what the dash one does for the main bill. If you want to see that, Chuck has not seen that.
Do you have copies of that? That'd be great.
Yes, sir.
Did you
have a dash one?
Yeah.
I don't have
an answer.
I can't believe I can't even find it.
See?
Nobody seems to know.
Seems like we're all short dash ones up here, so. Except me.
I tell you something. The administrator likes this at all.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's a complete gut and stuff, so.
Right.
It doesn't really matter.
This was the previous testimony you given to this committee was on this dash one amendment. For the committee's recollection, he did go through this quite extensively with us before. Well, we had it at our last hearing, so it should also have it. But anyway, we've got your sheet. If you want to. You want to give us a little rendition, and then we'll ask Mr. Taylor to talk about the dash two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Law and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I would generally describe the changes between the original bill and the dash one as addressing miscommunication between me as the coalition representative giving direction on the bill and Chuck Taylor as to what should be in it, mistakes that I made in preparing the coalition position and adding a couple of issues that the coalition agreed to after we initially gave direction to Chuck on what to put in the bill. There's 15 things there. I can review those if you want, or I could just take questions. I don't want to. I know you guys, you all have already had a hard day.
All the same. I'd like you just to review the dash one for us, even from your summary.
Sure. These are the significant changes made by the dash one to the original bill. Everything in the original bill stays essentially as it was, except for that in the original bill there were several sections that would have amended the existing statutes regarding landlord notice to tenants and to others regarding sales of the park. There are already statutes that cover this, that require a landlord to give notice of a sale of a park and require a landlord to negotiate in good faith with a residence or a resident group. The coalition had hoped to negotiate some improvements to those statutes. They're conflicting and confusing. I gave Chuck Taylor direction to copy what's in the New Hampshire statute. He did. The coalition didn't reach agreement on those issues. I'm hopeful that if the coalition survives, we'll be back whenever you meet again with that addressed again. The existing statutes still provide for notice and good faith obligation to negotiate. Regarding the tax credit, you heard testimony at your first hearing by some people who are being displaced by closure now saying please make it available for those of us who are displaced this year. With the assistance of Don Phillips, we were able to communicate with DOR, and DOR did not object to that. So the bill makes the tax credit available for this tax year. We also provided, if the closure is a result of eminent domain, in other words, the local government or the federal government or the state condemns a park, that you still get the credit. That's the way the law is now, but it'd be an offset by any compensation you receive as a result of the eminent domain. And then we made some technical changes that DOR asked us to make in the language that we use there. The original bill provided that payments by landlords to displaced tenants would not be treated as taxable income. We've made that effective for 2007 also. We are applying the closure provisions, the requirement that a landlord make payments, etc., to conversions as well as closures. A conversion is when a landlord converts the park to a subdivision and offers to sell the spaces to the tenants. Many of the tenants can't buy their space. They can't afford it. And if they don't, then the landlord essentially closes the park and evicts them. So we want the same benefits to go to those tenants because the result is the same. They're displaced. So we added that provision. Let me skip around and not do all of these. We've required the landlord to give a closure notice but no financial assistance to people who own a manufactured home but do not live in it. Some people own homes and then rent them out to subtenants. Those subtenants are not covered by the manufactured housing landlord tenant laws, and we want to give that owner, that the manufactured homeowner, notice that the park is closing and that he or she will have to move the home. We've also added a requirement that the landlord, for the first time, give notice to tenants if the park is being closed by eminent domain or government action. A government might close a park. That recently happened in Grants Pass, where DEQ found that the water was unsafe. In that case, it's not the landlord's choice directly. And we are, for the first time, saying the landlord has to give written notice to the tenants in that case and give the, tell them about the closure and give them some information about their rights. We amended the preemption provisions, which are in sections 4 and 5 of the bill, to make it clear that if a city has already, excuse me, if a park landlord has already given a closure notice, which is the case with Thunderbird and Wilsonville, that that is not preempted under the way Dash 1 is written. And at the request of Bend, we've added a provision saying that Bend or city can have incentive-based provisions for park closures that are not preempted by the bill. Bend, for example, has drafted an ordinance provision saying that if a landlord when it closes his park or her park, maintains some affordable units, that the landlord will get some density bonuses in exchange. We don't intend to, we don't want to preempt that sort of incentive-based program, and so we wrote that in there at the request of Bend. Requiring Housing Community Services to draft a form closure notice that landlords and tenants can help DLR, I mean HCS draft and make sure that it's consistent and has everything in it. The five-year property tax assessment freeze issue, which you've heard about, was not in the original bill. It is now in the dash ones. And then we've also made sure that the closure provisions, the requirements for landlords to make payments, the new provisions only apply to manufactured home parks and not also to marinas for floating homes. They would be covered by the existing law. And we've made some changes to the provisions that we passed last session about mandatory registration of landlords and mandatory education. In the 1 year that we've operated that program, we've learned some things. We've made some corrections. And for the first time, we're requiring landlords to maintain vacant spaces in a safe manner. Some parks have some spaces that are empty. So that's a lot.
Thank you. And Mr. Taylor, if you could introduce yourself and maybe give us what the Dash 2 is and how it differs from the Dash 1.
Sure. Chuck Taylor for Legislative Council, Chair Holvey members. The difference between the Dash 1s and Dash 2s is in the local preemption material, which is Sections 4 and 5 on both sets of amendments. As Mr. Van Landingham just said, the Dash 1 amendments preempt any local ordinances operating prospectively. We did put in a provision to allow voluntary incentives to the landlords, but otherwise the local ordinances cannot be applied if the closure notice is given on or after the effective date of the act, or if the closure notice was given before the local law was adopted, whether or not that was before or after the act was adopted. In the Dash 1s, Section 5 sub 2 is limited, as was just indicated, to the Wilsonville litigation. Technically, probably not necessary because the applicability provision in Section 5, Sub 1, makes it clear that that Section 4 doesn't affect doesn't affect the Wilsonville situation, because their law was in place before the closure notice was given, and it was given before the effective date of the act. The dash twos differ in that under the dash twos, a local government cannot create any new local law to regulate park closures. It also cannot come in and change an existing law to add park closure regulation or change the way that park closures are regulated. The local government can continue to enforce a local law regarding park closures if that local law gives tenants rights that are at least equal to what the tenants are being given under Sections 2 and 3 of the Act. So the dash 2s differ from the dash 1s in that the dash 1s are a total preemption of local ordinances. The dash 2s are a partial preemption, basically saying that the Section 2 and Section 3 rights are a floor if you have an existing law and that no new laws could be created. Section 5 is dealing again just with applicability. It does not specifically contain the material in the dash ones regarding the Wilsonville litigation. Again, though, I don't think that that has any substantive effect because of the way the operative dates are written. Section 4 is not going to apply.
So, Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding you correctly, then the real only difference is that the cities with existing ordinances governing manufactured dwelling parks are not preempted as long as they're providing an equal to or better protections for the tenants in their current ordinance. So it's just the cities with existing ordinances.
Under the dash twos, they could enforce a local ordinance if it is at least as favorable to the tenants. That's what we were saying.
But what I'm getting to is it's for a city that already has an ordinance.
Correct, for an existing ordinance. The dash ones would prohibit any ordinances.
Mm-hmm.
If I could clarify, the answer to your question is yes.
Thank you.
Lawyers have a hard time saying that. Except that cities can adopt a local ordinance or amend an existing ordinance within the 90 days after the end of session. So the effective date of the bill, which is 90 days after session. So that's important for Eugene, for example, whose ordinance is not better than HB 2735, but could be revised, and there's a proposal that would revise it.
But that section wouldn't apply to all cities in the state of Oregon. It would just apply to the three or four that already have existing ordinances.
I read it to say that any city that adopted an ordinance before the effective date would not be preempted.
It depends on when the ordinance becomes operative. Which the difference being if, say, the city of Eugene goes in and
Talk about city of Eugene for a second.
If any city
Let's talk about the city of Springfield.
How about McMinnville?
So I'll say the city of Springfield decided to, they don't have an existing ordinance right now. Would they be allowed to create their own ordinance under this bill?
They could if they made it to become operative before the effective date of the act. As was just mentioned, there's that 90-day window there. If they come in and enact an ordinance and they say it takes effect, say, June 1st, mm-hmm. 2008, they're going to be okay. If they come in, even if they enact it before this bill takes effect, if they say it isn't operative until January 1st, 2009, they're going to be out of luck. It has to actually be in place and operating before this bill takes effect.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask one of Mr. Taylor. Do you recall that a few years ago when this same bill was proposed in the state of Washington and it was struck down? When you were preparing this, did you investigate it?
Chair Hovey, Representative Nelson, I am not familiar with that.
I just, the reason I'm asking is because the Washington Supreme Court held the effort unconstitutional, and I just thought that's something we ought to know.
Questions? With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2735. Next on the agenda, I have House Bill 3485. Thank you.
It is your fault. How could I lose it? I've got 12 folders and you're winning one of them and I lost.
Steve, give us a rundown on House Bill 3485, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 3485 authorizes the creation of affordable housing covenant price restricting prices, rental rates, or occupancies to ensure adequate supply of rental or owner-occupied affordable housing for low or moderate income levels. Is Tad Everhart in the room? Thank you.
That's 3485.
Thank you. If you introduce yourself for the record and tell us a little bit about House Bill 3485.
Thank you, Chairman Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Tad Everhart. I'm a lawyer with the Community Development Law Center in Portland. And this is Kathy Armstrong. She's with Portland Community Land Trust, who's here this afternoon to answer questions if you have them. We've worked with legislative counsel over the last week since you heard this at first public hearing on the 13th to make a number of changes, and I'm hoping that the amendments have been delivered, although I'm not certain they have. Legislative Council delivered them. The attempt was to deliver them before 5 o'clock to Representative Dinkelder's office on Friday. My understanding is that they arrived after her staff had left, so her staff this morning sent a copy to us.
Well, seeing as how this committee, which the amendment should have been at least forwarded to, doesn't have the amendments, and it was my understanding that we were okay with this to move this without, wasn't aware you had amendments to it. So, you want to
Can we find out what the amendments are now?
Do you want to talk to us about what those amendments do to this bill, 3485?
Briefly, Chairman Holmey, the bills would clean up a number of small mistakes that were made in the initial drafting. It would change the definition of moderate income to 120% of area median income. There were some phrases that were positioned so it was not clear what operative words were being modified by those phrases, so Legislative Council has basically completely redrafted Section 3 to make it more clear. And the provisions for modifying and terminating affordable housing covenants were not clearly stated in the original, so those have been clarified. I don't believe that there are any substantive changes of a major nature, other than there was a concern about development standards that can be, or development agreements that local governments can enter into with private developers, and whether this bill would conflict with limits set forth on those development agreements. And so Legislative Council drafted a provision that indicates that these covenants would not be subject to the limits on development agreements. The two are considered different. These are limited to affordable housing provisions.
Okay. Any questions from the committee on this? This is, you know, since we don't have the amendments, we're not going to be able to work this bill at this point. So I would encourage you to, if in fact you can get your hands on those amendments, to deliver them to the committee administrator so we can distribute them to the committee.
I have a copy with me. If you're willing to take this up later in the afternoon, I can deliver them.
Very possible. If you leave it a copy with a committee assistant, we could maybe get copies for us to see.
Okay.
Is that a copy of the dash amendments from LC?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Sure. Great. If you could leave that with him, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3485. And with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3086. Steve, give us a brief summary of what we have with 3086, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 3086 revises motor vehicle liability insurance laws. There are dash one amendments before the committee, and that's it.
Dash one. Have somebody from the panel with us here.
Yes.
If we could have we'll start out with the trial lawyers and then perhaps have the insurance industry speak to us briefly about this bill. Things are going smoothly, so.
Why not?
Chairman Holman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I've taken a look at the Dash 1 amendments, and we do not support them. We support the original bill. The committee recalls when we first had the first public hearing on it, Ms. Mowry was here, the young lady who had had the horrible accident and lost her child. And Mrs. Valenti was also here. Mrs. Valenti had the horrible accident going to Disneyland, where her grandson and her son were seriously injured, and another young lad in the car was killed. The problem that we have with the Dash 1 amendments is they do not give the consumer what they think they're buying. What they do is they do expand the amount that would be available for medical bills. But the consumer, if you recall, what they think they're buying is, I'm buying 100,000 coverage. And it's in these catastrophic cases where they have paid the premiums for those kind of coverages, but because they are a family member or they are the insured, they are not entitled to recover that because of the language that is put into the insurance policies. Some of the policies I've looked on is on page 4, it's on page 7, and the language that is used on most of the policies says, it's in the exclusion section, and it says, we do not pay benefits for the insured or any member of their family or blood relative living in the same household. That's what the language says in there. So why is the insured paying the premium? Why are they buying $100,000 coverage? That's why we can't support the Dash 1, because it only goes to medical bills and it wouldn't make the consumer whole in these catastrophic cases. That's a hopeless position. No questions?
Representative Gerard.
Oh, thank you.
The question I have is still, pain and suffering is very much a part of the original bill. Are you willing to give on that, or is that just off the table?
We just don't think it makes the consumer whole, Representative Gerard, Chairman of the Committee. And that's what we're after. We're after the, giving the consumers what they think they're buying, what they're paying for.
Follow up.
Don't you think that there would be a conspiracy between the wife and the, or a husband and wife in order to elevate the pain and suffering clause?
No, I don't, for two reasons that I believe we spoke about earlier. One of the reasons is, with the state of medical science now, the idea of dumbing up a claim is very difficult to do. You have the same burdens of proof if you get in a dispute in this situation, where you must carry the burden of proof, which means you've got to have doctors, you've got to have the medical records to justify what it is that you are claiming to do. In terms of the, I would just flip it, Representative Gerard, I would just flip it and say, what we want to do is we want to allow the consumer, when they buy these bigger policies, they don't just buy them because if they may hit someone and terribly hurt them, they also buy them, they think they're buying them for their wives, for their kids. And what they don't know is if it's your wife or your kid, you're not getting that kind of coverage that you're paying for.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Point well taken about, you know, technology being such that you need pretty good documentation. But still, in this area of car accidents, the nebulous soft tissue issue, I mean, what has technology done to clarify that? Isn't that still a huge gray area?
Yeah, and it's the hardest thing to prove when you get into one of these disputes. For one thing, proving permanency of soft tissue injuries is very, very difficult to do. I mean, that's what we deal with this issue all the time, those of us who practice in this area. What we think we're talking about on these bigger injuries and bigger cases, we're talking about, like, Ms. Valenti still got the hardware in her leg from that accident. We're talking about, we know Tasha Mowry lost that baby, and what she didn't tell you is she has a child now, but her subsequent pregnancy was very, very difficult, and it was because of the injuries she sustained in the accident that she told you about. So your concern is legitimate, but from my perspective, as a consumer, a plaintiff's attorney, it's very difficult to prove permanency in soft tissue cases. It's just hard. It's hard to do.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Jackson, you know, I think there's some value in this bill. Is there any way you want to come up with how this should read and let us at least have a look-see?
Well, the original bill has the language that we believe carries out.
Oh,
what
just
we intended, yeah, without
total
the dash one.
That needs no...
Correct.
Correcting, okay.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that part of this bill addresses an issue that we discussed in Judiciary Committee in House Bill 2908, which is, you remember Mr. Surface, who was here with his wife, and he talked about the accident because she was hit by a truck that was owned by a government, right? So we passed out of Judiciary House Bill 2908, which addresses that issue. So I don't know what we do when, you know, it hasn't arrived at the floor yet, but I don't know what we do with it when an issue is duplicative. It basically addresses the same concern. So the part of the dash, I would support at least the part of the dash one amendment to take that part out because it's addressed in another bill.
Yeah, oftentimes there's conforming amendments. That
all happens at the end.
In the end.
Yeah.
And that
big freshman ignorance about how we do.
Makes you crazy.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much. And if I could call up Mr. Powell, please.
I need to be back in 5 minutes. I'm going next to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chair and members, where Mr. Jackson and I disagree is the type of coverage we're talking about. You've been to PIP school, and we've talked a lot about that coverage in here, and that's the coverage you buy to protect you and your family members and any other passenger in your car for medical issues. The coverage at issue in this bill is your liability coverage. When you buy liability coverage, to protect your assets if you hit another party. And it changed when, through a court decision, not through an insurance industry decision, but the courts held that under the Oregon Financial Responsibility Law, that's the law that says you have to carry an auto insurance and it has to have these limits, the court held that those minimum limits apply to family members. So that's how we got any family member coverage in the auto insurance policy. This bill then simply modifies that by taking off any kind of limits and allowing the entire liability policy that is primarily designed in case you hit another party and makes that a household coverage that can be claimed against by your own family members. Our compromise language on this would allow that person to go to the policy limits based on economic damages, and those are cited in the bill. And its economic damages include future income loss, ability to work, all meds, and those types of expenses. What would not be included in that would be claims for pain and suffering. And so that's the reason we bring this amendment to you. We think it holds true to the concept, or truer to the concept, of pure liability insurance, where it's designed in case you're at fault in an accident and injure someone else.
He's describing Dash 1, correct?
Yes.
He's describing Dash 1, yes. Questions? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. John, what would that limit be on page 2 of the amendment? It says you may limit the coverage for bodily injury and death. What's that minimum there? Is there one?
Are you on page 2 of the amendment?
Yes, sir.
And which line?
It starts with 28.
Oh, okay. That language simply puts in the law for the first time that there is a limit on liability for household parties.
How would
because that was due to a judicial decision, and it's in your insurance policy now. This says it would be limited to that, and then above that that limit, you could go to the full policy limits for economic damages.
Okay, so I'm just a little concerned. This is totally vehicular.
Mr. Chairman,
is that correct?
Representative Nelson, yes.
Any kind of vehicle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, any kind of vehicle that requires a motor vehicle insurance policy.
Let me just ask one more question.
One more, go ahead.
Okay, I'm back to this family member issue. This will be personal, but if I were driving a car and an ex-policeman ran a stop sign and hit us and pushed us head onto a Cadillac that had 8 kids in it, I have liability. Okay. If the individual who ran the stop sign has no insurance, no estate, is that when my policy kicks in and takes care of my father's hospitalization for 11 months in a coma before he died, and these 8 children?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, you have a series of coverages that would kick in. Primarily, your uninsured motorist coverage is designed for that very situation. Or if you get hit by somebody that has lower limits than you do, and your injury exceeds their limits, if you have purchased more uninsured motorists, it becomes underinsured motorists, which covers for the additional amount.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Paul. Committee will stand at ease for a minute.
Bill 3086. Next up. What about coming next? I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2656. Can I have Mr. Long, please?
Good afternoon.
House Bill 2656. We're in work session at the moment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long with State Building Codes Division. You should have 2656-3 in front of you, which are the consensus amendments that we've brought forward to you. What I can do is talk to you about what we're trying to accomplish in this bill. This is the training and certification for folks who work on envelopes and general contractors. There's been some issues that we've had testimony on in the past around deck installation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have around that. Manufactured housing, we've solved the issue related to when the certification would be required for manufactured housing in the dash three amendments, and we have clarified the issue as far as what the certified individual is supposed to do on the job site, and that is to substantially observe the building envelope work. We had some discussion at the last hearing about on-site. How do you determine on-site? How don't you? What's the responsibilities? And last week we got everybody together and basically made changes to Section 2 of the Dash 1 amendments that we had a previous hearing on. At our previous meeting, Mr. Chair, I provided you kind of a section-by-section overview. I don't know if the members still have that. It's still applicable, except for the Section 2 changes that I just talked about. I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have regarding the pieces that we've attempted to address through the decks or the manufactured housing or the on-site piece.
Mr. Long, have you looked at the Dash 4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I just got the Dash 4 before lunch, and Section 11 of the Dash 4's impact the Landscape Contractors Board and the issue of deck installation. What we had in the Dash 3, just so the committee understands, is that if you attach a deck to a structure, essentially piercing the envelope of the building, we wanted you to have the training and education and licensure under the Construction Contractors Board. That's what the Dash 3s do, whether they're a landscape individual or a general contractor, or subcontractor, etc. The Dash 4s appear to take the landscape contract, the folks that are licensed by the Landscape Contractors Board, and set up a training structure, a bond structure, etc. I've looked at it. We spent as much time as we could since this morning reviewing the drafts. I can't commit to you that you have equal protection under this draft as you do under the CCB law for contractor insurance requirements, claim requirements, notice requirements, and enforcement. And I would need to get some advice from our counsel on whether or not, if you're a CCB-licensed individual penetrating the envelope by installing a deck, those protections that are afforded to a consumer versus the landscape contractor, whether you have the same protections in those areas. You might, because it looks like we've dealt, the amendments deal with a greater bond requirement and some notification requirements, but I haven't been able to determine whether they're equal to the CCB laws. And that's been my concern from day one, is providing equal protection so you didn't have a different tier of assistance available to consumers with two different contractors doing the work.
So I know that Bill Cross just walked in. Maybe I could get him come up while you're still sitting there. Oh, I saw him walk in. Did he walk out? Oh, there he is.
He's sitting there.
He's trying to hide.
If you could real briefly tell us the difference between
the dash four, and I believe it's the dash two that three that we're working on. That's right. Three and four, that makes sense.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm representing the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and the principal difference is found page 6, thank you. Section 11, where it talks about if the contractor is a licensed landscape contractor for the purposes of physically attaching a deck, which currently under the landscape licensure laws they are able to do, they would be able to employ or retain a building envelope specialist, certified building envelope specialist, and assuming they then, and the bill would require them to provide the same level of bonding and insurance as a CCB contractor, and then go ahead and get be able to perform the work on an attached deck. They would then have to, you'll see reporting requirements. They'd have to do the checklist, which would need to be submitted as well. So it would be identical to the building envelope certifications or specialist certification and process that CCB licensees would need to use for deck installations, but it would eliminate the requirement that the landscape contractor be licensed by CCB, as well as obviously already being licensed by the landscape contractors board.
So, Mr. Long, do you wish to? You had previously stated that you weren't sure there was equal protection for consumers under. Under the dash four in the scenario Mr. Cross has just laid out.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the dash four appear to do a pretty good job on the bonding piece, and then they do mirror the certification and the notice, as Mr. Cross indicated. There are other components in the kind of the CCB tent of how they deal with consumer problems as far as notice to consumers, those upfront notices that are provided on issues. I don't see that, but it might be there. Again, I don't. You need a little bit more time than what we've had this morning. I also am not sure about the timing of when you can file a claim and the process that the consumer goes through. We tried to do a comparison. We're unable to come up with the conclusive that they're equal. Breach of contract, I know, is something the CCB has the ability to address. I'm not sure if LCB does or not in these kinds of issues, and we need to check that. And then the enforcement mechanism. In the dash threes, we attempt to try to deal with the enforcement, give CCB the authority to deal with the certification and the contractors and working with local government folks. I don't know if we have it in here or not. I didn't see it, but that doesn't mean that it isn't there. So maybe Bill would be more familiar with those issues.
Mr. Chair, the LCB's enforcement requirements, notice requirements are all based on CCBs. They patterned those over the years so that when the complaints received, they literally follow the same CCB process.
Thank
so
you.
I think those protections are there. I tried to mirror them.
Thank you. I think I'm going to call up Legislative Council real quick to, and I thank you for your testimony on this, since I called him back into action, into the hot seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Taylor, identify yourself for the record, and we're asking about the difference between the dash fours and the dash threes and how that works for the consumer.
Chair Holvey, members, Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. The main difference is that a landscaping business under the dash fours could get an identification from the state landscape contractors board to basically allow them to do the physical attachment of the decks as long as they meet certain insurance and bonding requirements. The enforcement mechanism is as far as requiring the identification as such is that we are creating an exception to the requirement
or to the prohibition against someone doing this type of work without a CCB license. So if a landscaping business did not have a valid identification from the Landscape Contractors Board and did not have the CCB license, they're going to be subject to the CCB sanctions. In that respect, they're no different than any other unlicensed construction contractor. The timing, I don't have the amendments in front of me, but my recollection is that we amended those statutes to put claims that are against the landscape contractors for the attachment of a deck under the regular landscape contractors claim process.
Are you aware whether that landscaper claim process provides equal or protections to the consumer than as does the construction contractors board claims process?
As far as the process itself?
Well, the process and the protections.
Okay. The bond amounts and insurance amounts are pegged toward what are currently the requirements for a residential-only contractor licensed by the CCB. So that is equal as far as the resources that are available. I believe the timing provisions as far as paying out from a bond are identical for the two. I am not sure whether the claim process with the landscape contractors is exactly identical with CCB. The CCB has fairly elaborate provisions for alternative dispute resolution, and I don't know offhand if that's available with the landscape contractors.
Thank you. Any quick questions from the committee?
A quick question.
Pardon
me if I missed this, but I had to be somewhere else for a few minutes. Thank you for being here. At one point, we had a concern raised that there was no requirement that the building envelope specialist be on the site. Was that something that was addressed in either the -2, -3, or -4 amendments?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, I believe that both the -3s and -4s address that.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
I've looked at the -3. I haven't seen the -4, but the -3 does not say that the specialist has to be on site. And it does go somewhat towards that. If you look at the bottom of page 1 of the proposed amendments, the last line, they put in "shall substantially observe." And while I don't think that's quite strong enough, I'm willing to go along with it. It's better than nothing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, you're correct that it does not require a particular building envelope specialist to constantly monitor the entire process. This would, for instance, allow a specialist to walk back and forth between two structures that are being built side by side. As long as they are getting in a substantial amount of observation on each structure.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to recess the House Committee on Consumer Protection until 6 p.m.
3:43.
In room 3:43.
6 p.m. or 5 p.m.?
6.
The House Committee on Consumer Protection. We're going to enter into some work sessions here, and we're going to have House Bill 3485 first. So I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3485. And could Tad Everhart come forward now? Are these mine? Or? Yeah. Let me get those out of your way. Thank you once again. Why don't you introduce yourself for the record, and now that we have the 3485-1 amendments, maybe we can have a little more discussion about it.
Thank you, Chairman Holby. Tad Everhart with the Community Development Law Center of Legal Aid Services of Oregon in Portland, Oregon. With me is Kathy Armstrong, who's with Portland Community Land Trust.
Okay. So if you could just give us a brief summary of the bill and the Dash 1 amendment and what it does to the bill.
The bill, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee, would protect affordable housing covenants that various entities use to ensure and maintain housing, both rental and homeownership housing, as affordable. Typically, these covenants have a long duration. They might be subject to legal uncertainty in light of many common law principles that still have uncertain application by Oregon courts. So by enacting a statute, we would do what other states have done, which is to recognize the importance of these covenants and protect them in light of the uncertainty that may exist over their legal effect and enforceability. This statute is actually quite similar to the statute that protects projects that are sponsored by Oregon Housing and Community Services. OHCS has a statute that provides that its housing covenants are effective against any common law acts. In addition, there's a statute that applies to conservation easements and scenic preservation easements, and this act is actually borrows a lot from that statute. I'm happy to answer questions as to the amendments. Again, we missed some things in working with Mr. Conley of Legislative Council. Those matters have been added. In particular, we changed the definition from nonprofit corporation as an eligible covenant holder to two of the three kinds of nonprofit corporations. We did not include mutual benefit nonprofits. There were changes to make Section 3 more clear by moving the definition of subsidy up to this definition section, and then there was a change that I alluded to earlier today to make it clear how this bill and the legislation would square with the development standards and development agreements legislation.
Thank you. Do you wish to make any comments, or?
Not right now, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Does the committee have any questions on House Bill 3485 and the Dash 1 amendment? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick context question. Nationally, how does Oregon sort of compare, I'm just using your language here, in decent, safe, sanitary, affordable to low and moderate income households? How would you say we compare?
Chairman Hovey and Representative Gilliam, I don't know. I think we're all doing our best here. I know that there are only four other states that have a statute like this, so I hope that having a statute would put us in the short list of states that are doing everything legally to protect the status of housing that's subsidized and set aside for long-term use by people of low or moderate income.
Thank you.
President Nelson.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. The issue that I was concerned about last time related to transferability, and what did you find out?
I remember your question, Representative Nelson and Chairman Holby. I think we provided that the bill would not apply to property that's sold. In other words, it doesn't require that there be a like-kind property created if an affordable housing unit is lost. However, the bill does provide that if a covenant is terminated by a court, the difference between the restricted value and the free market value of the property would be passed to the covenant holder, and the idea would be that the covenant holder could then invest that amount of money into a new affordable housing unit.
Okay, excuse me, Mr. Taylor,
follow up.
Could you tell me where I'll find that in here, please? I think I've read too many bills this week already.
I know
just
it's
began.
Representative Nelson, I believe it's in Section 3, in Subsection 6, as amended. That upon termination, the covenant holder is entitled to receive the difference between fair market value immediately before termination and the fair market value immediately after termination. That's to preserve the subsidy to be. In other words, there'd be no financial incentive for someone to say, let's get rid of this restriction, because in fact they would have to pay the difference between the restricted value and the fair market value. Otherwise, we're worried that people would just be fighting these things and trying to pocket the subsidy in the future.
Question? Representative Bonamici, question?
No, I'd like to make a motion, though. Are you ready?
I'm in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3485.
Representative Bonamici moves we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3485. A discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3485 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 3485 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Riley, if you could please give us a roll call.
Aye.
Is there any, can I get a motion to put this on the consent calendar? I think this is, or would somebody like to have it on the floor?
Mr. Chair, I recommend a discussion. Because
fine.
I don't think they'd understand it.
You know, that's fine. Do I have a volunteer for a carrier then?
I was going to suggest that we ask Representative Dingfelder if she'd like to carry it since it's her bill.
Cool.
Okay. There's a.
Now I will carry it if she doesn't.
Okay. We'll assign Representative Dingfelder this bill to carry on the floor. If she declines, Representative Bonamici can step in.
And if Representative Bonamici doesn't want to carry it, I'll carry it.
And
if Representative Galicio doesn't want to...
With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3485 before it gets any worse.
Mr. Chair, everything went so well. Maybe we should just close.
Yeah, maybe it would be a good time to end on a nice, good note.
A unanimous vote. Gosh.
Mr. Riley.
With that, I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2735.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move that we amend House Bill 2735 with a Dash 2 amendment.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2735. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'm going to, unfortunately, for the vote count, I will be a no on the Dash 1s, but if Representative Roddy wants to recommend the Dash 1s, I'd be happy to support him.
We have a motion on the Dash 2s. Any other discussion?
I think we should go with the Dash 1s as well.
Dash 2s. We're moving on the Dash 2s. There's a motion on the Dash 2s.
Because I won't vote for the bill if you do the Dash 2s. I would vote for the bill if you did the Dash 1s.
So noted. Seeing no further discussion, let's have a roll call on the adoption of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I missed the first motion.
The motion was to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2735.
And the Dash 2 amendment is the one that has the preemption except for existing ordinances.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And I
for ordinances that are in existence when the bill goes into effect, I believe.
Right. And I just, since we're discussing, I know there's been a lot of discussion about this. There's been a lot of discussion about preemption and the work of the work group. I'm going to vote for the Dash 2 amendments just because I think we need to do something to get protection for people in the state. And if that doesn't work, I'd also support the Dash 1. I truly believe that we need to do something for the people who are affected by this.
So noted. Any other discussion?
I have the same conclusion, except that's why I'm for the one.
Right. Well, I'm going to be supporting the Dash 2s. I would also support the Dash 1s, but I think the Dash 2s recognize the cities that have adopted ordinances to deal with this, and they provide tenants with, in those cities that have adopted ordinances, at least as good a protection, if not better, in the bill. And for that reason, I'm going to be supporting the Dash 2s on this particular bill. Representative Giroir.
The problem I have is we put a work group together to come up with a conclusion. And I think this really sets a bad precedent that if you sit at the table and work out a conclusion, then they bring it to the legislature, that you can tear this conclusion apart and you get schmucked. And I think that the landowners in this case dealt in good faith, and I think that this is kind of thrown it in their face. And that's the problem I have with it. If they would have started with this, I could have very easily ended there. That's not where the work group took it.
Yeah. I hear your concerns, but I also recognize a lot of testimony we had from cities and tenants who did not want the preemption, and cities have already made, you know, commitments to having ordinances around these things, and I believe that, you know, we shouldn't take what they've already done away from them. I just don't feel that we should preempt those cities that have already been proactive in this area.
Mr. Chair.
And seeing how they provide at least as good a benefit for the tenants that this particular bill does, I think I'm going to be supportive of this. And I don't think that folks should hold the coalition accountable for what the legislature does, but you know, we're considering policy, and I think it's good policy to recognize those ordinances that have been adopted locally. You know, we always hear about preemption and local control, and, in this particular arena, I think if cities want to provide protections for their community, they have an ability to address their community. So that's.
I'm sorry, were you finished?
I am now, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to add also for the record that I heard from a lot of residents and people again and again concerned about not recognizing their local protections. And I agree with the chair that when there's a community that wants to provide protection and already has, that we should recognize that. And again, not that it reflects poorly on a work group. Lots of times there are work groups that come to us and then there's a change that's made for policy reasons.
So with that, I want a roll call vote on the adopting the Dash 2 amendment, please.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative
Gerard? No.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Chair Holby?
Aye. The Dash 2 amendments are passed and adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move that we move the House Bill 2735 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a subsequent derivative.
And was that with a due pass recommendation?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Riley moves House Bill 2735 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to revenue. Representative Galizio.
Discussion. I'm going to be supportive, but I did want to note, and I hope the folks on revenue will really take a close look at the five-year tax freeze. Washington County, for example, is very concerned about the economic impact, and I think they have a really legitimate concern about a five-year tax freeze on new development. The taxpayers are going to have to reimburse developers for this. And so, I will be supportive, but I think that's a legitimate concern. Counties have a lot of pressure on them post-Measure 37 and other ways, and so we have to be quite aware of that.
Mr. Chair.
I
want to reiterate the concerns raised by Representative Galizio that are a concern of Washington County, which is where my district is, about the five-year tax freeze. And I, again, along with Representative Galizio, hope that revenue takes a look at that. It's significantly affects my county.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
While we're doing this.
Washington County?
Washington County and others. I've heard others with the same concern. It's not just Washington County. I certainly have heard from Washington County. I've heard from other counties as well. And I would like to say the same thing. If we had that amendment in front of us now, I would go there, but we don't have. So we'll go where we have one.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Chair Hovey. I will be a no vote on House Bill 2735 because of the issue I brought up earlier today. And doing further research, we do feel that it is unconstitutional.
Time will tell. Representative Riley, or Mr. Riley, can you give us a roll call vote on the motion?
Representative Galizio?
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam? No.
Representative
Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Chair Holden?
Aye. House Bill 2735, having received the majority votes, is passed on to the House Committee on Revenue. I'd like to close a work session on House Bill 2735. And open a work session on House Bill 3086.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 3086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
We're not doing any amendments.
The motion was on House Bill 3086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's a bit of dash ones. I mean, I'm just trying to make there's a lot less opposition to it. And in all honesty, I don't see how you can not, if you include pain and suffering, I just think that that's really a wrong thing to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I just want to respond to the comment made by my good colleague here, Representative Gerard. And as Mr. Jackson testified, these things are not easy to prove. Damages are quite difficult to prove, and there are standards that need to be met and proof that needs to be entered into evidence, and this just gives an opportunity to do that. It doesn't say that it's going to happen, and it is a tough burden, and I think it's important to have that in there.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, did we forget we had a dash one amendment?
we didn't forget it. Representative Riley made a motion on the bill without the dash one amendment. The difference in the bills being that, as I understand it, that the original bill includes the family member being able to recover pain and suffering like any other claimant, injured party, and the dash one amendment does not allow that pain and suffering.
allows them to recover it if they can prove it.
If they can prove it, correct. So that being said, the motion is on House Bill 3085 without amendments. 3086. Any other discussion? Mr. Riley, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
President
Gillian?
No.
President
Gerard?
No.
President Riley?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3086, having received majority votes, is declared passed.
Mr. Chair, I serve notice of a potential minority report.
Representative Gerard serves notice of a minority report, so noted. With that, I close the work session on House Bill 3086, and does anyone wish to volunteer to carry that one on the floor?
Mr. Chair, I will, because I'm carrying this similar, I'm carrying 2908 from Judiciary, which has a similar provision in it, with regard to the...
Well, that would be awfully convenient for you to carry both. I appreciate you volunteering.
My pleasure.
I close the work session on House Bill 3086. Next up, we have like to open a work session on House Bill 2656.
Mr. Chair.
Hold it. Let us find it first, Chuck.
Yes. I want to ask a question.
Representative Riley.
Is the dash 4 all inclusive of the amendments? Is the dash 3 included in the dash 4? Or is that stand alone?
Mr. Long and Mr. Taylor, could you approach us, please?
Yes, it's good evening, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long with State Building Codes. I believe 2656-4 is all inclusive of the dash 3. Section 11, I believe, is the new language that's the difference between the two amendments. I'm looking to counsel to see if I'm correct.
We sort of went over this in our earlier testimony today, but we'll just recap it for the committee. Mr. Taylor, if you can again tell us the difference between the dash 4 and the dash 3, which are the two amendments we're considering, or at least I think we're considering.
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, the dash 4s contain all of the dash 3s. The difference is that they add the new section dealing with the landscape contractors. And they also make a few conforming amendments to the state landscape contractor sections to accommodate that.
And I note that we have the construction contractors board and the landscaping board both sitting in the audience, too. I don't know if they wish to comment on this policy or not, but
they don't appear to.
Mr. Chair, if I might... we've had a chance.
For the record, you're
Mark Long. Since 3 o'clock, and now we've had a chance to go back and ask folks to look at the issue, and on filing the claims, the notices, enforcement, and timing, we believe it's substantially similar. The provisions in for landscape as the construction contractors board. There are probably four things I would point out to you. Which I think can be rectified quite easily. One, for the insurance coverage, you may recall we are asking the CCB licensed contractors to have completed operations. You did pass that bill out, 2654. That doesn't include that here, and I suspect that we could deal with that. Two, there is an access issue to the bond. CCB has a limitation on bond for non-owners to access of, I believe, $3,000. That's essentially the material suppliers and others, non-consumers. We didn't see that limitation in current law, but I understand there's a bill that's passed the Senate that's going to do that. So that issue is probably being resolved with pending legislation. And then the only other thing to point out to you is this applies. It's broadly applied. It can apply to commercial and residential, just so that you know, because in our earlier discussions we were thinking residential only. And then the last thing, just so that you know, which I don't think is a problem that can be worked out, is that should there be a problem and a leak occurs because of a deck installation, the remedy to the consumer would be covered by the insurance bond, but not the ability for the contractor to make the repair, because they wouldn't be licensed to do work on the structure itself. And so that's a little bit different, but I think that can be overcome as well. So that's what we found in the last, as I said, 3 hours looking at this amendment that we received today. So,
any questions from the committee of our panelists? And Representative Nelson, question?
Yes. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to be sure that what I perceive is in here. I'm just going to make this statement.
Mm-hmm.
This amendment would require landscape contractors to get the building envelope specialist certification without having to be licensed by CCD and the Landscape Contractors Board. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, no. They would still have to be licensed by the Landscape Contractors Board. It's my understanding. I'm going to look back to the proponent.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendments to House Bill 2656.
Representative Riley has moved the dash four amendments to House Bill 2656. Discussion?
Just a brief comment. I'm very glad that we're moving this bill. This has been one that we've talked about a lot. We've heard a lot of testimony about how important it is, and so I'm thrilled to be moving it on.
I thank you for that. I guess I'll make a comment here, too. I do have some concerns about the policy of landscape contractors doing penetrations to the envelope and installing what essentially becomes structure inside the envelope, and sort of going back and forth between construction contractor work and landscape work, it sort of laps over. But it is, you know, my opinion that this committee has heard from the folks on both sides of this issue, and they'll decide by majority vote on which way this particular amendment goes. It just did trouble me a little bit that we now have landscape contractors who will be performing structure work on houses inside the envelope, potentially, with this bill. And so that did cause me some concern, and I know a lot of others had concern on that and have taken this back and forth. But having said that, I know the Landscape Contractors Board's been doing a good job with gearing up their education and looking at all those issues. But notwithstanding that, any other comments?
I have a comment. I'm happy with the landscaper part, actually. But I continue to worry about the small guy. I mean, if there's one thing we did get early on in this committee, it's the importance of the envelope, and particularly with our climate and all. I understand that. But I am worried about the little guy and just the burden of, a broken window in a rural part of my district, and the training and the all the requirements. But nonetheless, I'll be supporting this.
As long as it's hidden in your window.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we all share that concern for small business, but at the same time, we have a commitment to people are in a business, and we set regulations and requirements and standards to protect the public, and if they want to be in that business, they need to conform to that. I hope that I don't think it will be a real burdensome item for people to obtain this certificate. It's just going to take some demonstrated effort on their part to get the
education and the competency, I guess, they need to get this certificate. So I hope that this does make a positive impact on the industry and on protecting consumers. Clearly, I would have liked to have seen a lot more training and certification out there. You know, that people ought to be trained on what they're doing out there and doing it right. But I think this is a step in the right direction. We have at least one person that's hopefully going to be watching the installation process.
He's someplace near it.
Well, substantially observing it, I think, means that they're going to have to be somewhat close to it.
Okay.
So, with that, I have a motion to adopt the -4 amendment. I would like a roll call vote on that, Mr. Riley.
Aye.
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 -4.
Aye.
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 No. With that, the adoption of the -4 amendment, or the -4 amendment's adopted. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2656 as amended with the -4 to the House and be passed recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2656 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I'm just pained to vote against, to vote for a bill that the amendment was opposed by my chair. It causes me great consternation, but I think I'm still going to support
it. Oh, yeah, it doesn't hurt at all.
Join me.
It's got to happen one time in a session.
Yeah.
Or in a session.
Point well taken.
I'd like the maker of the motion to amend that motion with a subsequent referral of Ways and Means.
Okay. I amend it so that it has a subsequent to the Ways and Means.
Okay. Let me restate the motion. Yeah. So, Representative Riley moves House Bill 2656 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I believe that's the correct way to do it. So.
Yes.
Mr. Riley, well, I keep promoting you today.
I'm not sure that's a promotion, Mr. Chair.
It'd be a loss in pay for sure.
That's for sure.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
President Gerard?
No.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Bonici?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Chair
Holby?
Aye.
House Bill 2656, having received the majority votes, is declared passed. I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2656 and open a work session on House Bill 2657. Yeah. Let's see, who do we want to come up this time? Mr. Taylor and Mr. Long.
What's this one?
2657. In committee, we have -2 amendments on this bill. And hopefully Mr. Long and Mr. Taylor can walk us through the amendments to this bill.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Mark Long for the record. 2657-2, the difference between -1 and -2 is contained in Section 4. The rest of the bill is the same, from what I recall, between -1 and -2. 2657, this is the consumer information bill that does several different things. Early on, we talked about providing notice to consumers through the contract, providing a offer for a written warranty, which is included in here, an offer for maintenance information, which is included in here, standardized information for the consumer, kind of be contained in the first part of the contract so that they would be aware of these various elements and giving CCB the ability to address that. Also contained within this bill is an increase in the bond amount by $5,000. And then in Section 4 gives my department the ability to look at issues of certificate of occupancy, uniform permit application requirements, and inspection standards. Again, the differences between Dash 1 and Dash 2 was an amendment we made in Section 4 to address concerns from local government. I don't know if you want to add anything, Chuck, or not.
Nothing to add.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Could you just say a little bit more about the main concern the local government had on that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, there was concern that, especially around the standardized inspections, that if the state created a uniform list, that there may be items that weren't on the list that a local official may see. We don't know what those are yet. And so what we talked about was making sure that the law allowed us to create or recognize a unique condition, I think is the word, or conditions that are unique. Okay, I got it close. And the ability to establish something that may not be on the standardized checklist for either a specific local jurisdiction or broadly to allow for a process that if it wasn't on the list, that the building official could require something in addition, but go through a process of making a finding or something like that. We're going to have to work that out in the administrative rule, but local government wanted that clarified in the statute that we had that ability and that the standard list wouldn't be a one-size-fits-all in all situations.
Okay.
Hope I answered your question.
Yes, thank you very much.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. When we look at Section 4 of the Dash 2, you know, this is this age-old issue of shall or may.
Mm-hmm.
On line 14.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, may means if you want to. Shall means yes, you will. So I'm just curious of what you intended.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, again, this gives us permissive authority, you're correct, to address some of the recommendations that the task force brought forward around certificate of occupancies, standardized inspections, and permit application information. We didn't feel that it was necessary to lay out all those details in statute, nor could we, because we're going to have to go through a rulemaking. So it gave us the authority to address it if we can get consensus among local government, contractors, inspectors, all the folks that I work with, about how to set up these uniform permit applications, how to set up standardized inspections, how to deal with certificate of occupancies. And that's why we took the permissive approach, because there's still quite a bit of work to be done through rulemaking, but the task force felt it was important for us to have these tools that if we came up with something, notwithstanding the added language, it would be carried out uniformly statewide.
I'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So do you think it's clear here, dear? Is this clear what a certificate of occupancy is?
I was surprised.
Right. To find out what it really is in your definition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson,
sure.
I believe it's clear. We, in the building code, have used certificate of occupancies for commercial construction for many years now, and a lot of folks are familiar with a temporary C of O or a final C of O, kind of gives you final occupancy, financing banks, a whole bunch of things kind of trigger that. In the residential area, which this will help us, it's been kind of hit and miss all over the state as far as whether jurisdictions have this ability, whether they're using it, whether they use some other instrument called a final inspection. So I think it's clear. What I do want to point out to the committee for folks to understand, this is only related to building code items. So there are many things a local jurisdiction looks at that they may attach to their certificate of occupancy. They have nothing to do with building code items. Lawns, trees, shrubs. Those kinds of things. We're talking about the structure. Go ahead.
I just don't want to belabor this, but doesn't certificate of occupancy really mean that the structure complies with municipal requirements as well as the adopted state building code?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, in the context of our law under State Building Codes Division in this chapter law that we have, 455, which is, I believe, that this is going to be added, our purview is only over state building code items. So that's the integrity of the structure itself from a life safety and code compliance standpoint.
Last follow-up, please.
One more, yeah.
So basically what we're telling the cities then is that don't make any, you know, regulations regarding building because, you know, we're going to have, we just do what the state wants, not what the city wants.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure about that. Right now we have a state code where we adopt the standards and it's uniformly carried out statewide. This is the process of making sure what is going to be required on a statewide basis in that final certificate of occupancy. That is the piece that we're going to want local government to make sure that is that the building is in a complete stage. A temporary one can be issued if you don't have, for example, maybe your elevator, and I'm making this up, I'm shooting from the hip, but your life safety components, your sprinkler systems, your alarm systems would be in, as an example. This would make that, would allow us to address this on a uniform basis.
Mr. Chair. Good question. So to get a certificate of occupancy, a city could add to your requirements, but they can't subtract from your requirements. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, that's correct. They could add to it on the non-building code items.
Got it.
Representative Girard.
The right to repair, is that anywhere in the bill here, or was that omitted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I don't believe this modified the right to repair statute. I think in one of the original bill, I'm trying to remember the genesis of your question, the original bill, I believe, modified the right to repair statute, but I don't think it modifies that area of law at all. If you give me just a second, I'm going to double check to make sure I'm accurate, okay?
What's the right to repair statute?
Page 3, line 12.
That's just the notice. Representative Girard, there are notice requirements for the right to repair, but changing the right to repair, I think, is in 701560, Chuck, and I don't think we amend that at all.
Chair Holby, Representative Girard, the right to repair is located in ORS 455-765, and we are not amending that statute or any of the statutes in that series in this bill.
Mr. Chair?
I think originally it was in the original
in these
bill.
Amendments,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2657.
Okay.
Representative Bonamici moves that we adopt the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2657. Yeah. Further discussion? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make this statement for the good of the day. I'm going to trust this good man here who's just testified before us, but I just want to say this, that what I feel now, based on what you said, is that jurisdictions like municipal and local still have the discretion to adopt additional permit application requirements to ensure that the structure complies with municipal requirements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that isn't exactly what I'm trying to say here. So if I've confused you, I apologize. We are going to set a statewide standard that will allow a process for jurisdictions to provide for an additional inspection or an additional requirement if necessary. But we're going to have to go through rulemaking to figure out what that is, and this language allows for that. I am only cautious because I do not want to send a message to you or anybody else that there is a blank check. We're going to go through a process to determine what's appropriate, and I'll need to make findings. So that's my only hesitation here.
And I guess I'm going to add a comment too on specifically on the warranty. We did, you know, compromise with the warranty being able to be opted out of, basically. But we're requiring them to offer a warranty. I remain concerned about that particular warranty that's being offered because there is no, in this bill, standard warranty, and I think that will become an issue for the consumers, for the public, because one particular builder may offer a warranty on the paint and nothing else, or one builder may offer a warranty on a defect, a structural defect, but not something else. And I think that's going to be confusing for consumers, and I have actually requested that we have another bill separate from this one so as not to jeopardize this particular bill that actually asks that that there be a standard warranty that would be offered. I know that not everybody will agree with that idea, but I think it's a conversation this committee needs to have as we move forward. If they're going to be opting out of a warranty, I think there ought to be a standard warranty that's offered. Not saying that they can't offer settle on a different warranty, but I think initially I think there ought to be a standard warranty offered, but we'll take that up on a different day. So another comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Similarly, I wanted to express on page 3 in the paragraph about the written notice of cancellation prior to midnight at the end of the next business day. We had a discussion when we were talking about that provision with Representative Girard, who said, what if, for example, somebody drives out to my home and I want them to start working right away? And I think that's how that ended up in here, that if both parties agree that the work is to begin before cancellation period has expired, they should be able to do that because they don't want to incur the additional expense of going and then coming back a day later. That being said, I want to make sure that this isn't, that there's not sort of a pro forma waiver of that right when it's practical to give the consumer the right to think about it till the next business day. That's the whole purpose of having that in there, and I hope that that doesn't get waived regularly, but in fact is a provision that's used when needed.
So now that we're all on the record,
I've moved the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Bonamici has moved the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments. We've had discussion on moving the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2657. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2657.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2657 is amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Representative Bonamici has moved House Bill 2657 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. Is any discussion on the main motion? Mr. Riley, the roll, please.
Representative Leahy?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
No.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2657, having received the majority of votes, is declared passed. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2657. Committee, on our agenda as well, we have four other bills that were on our agenda for today. House Bill 2621, House Bill 3186, House Bill 3081, and House Bill 2002. I'd like to carry those four bills over
to Tuesday, tomorrow at 6 p.m., which is our next scheduled meeting, and I don't expect that meeting will take very long.
Which are you carrying over?
House Bill 2621, House Bill 3186.
First two and last two.
House Bill 3081 and House Bill 2002. Carried over till tomorrow at 6 p.m.
I was just surprised because you said something that includes House Bill 2621 wasn't going to take very long.
Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Nelson.
Is there any possibility you could open the work session on 2621 for just a moment so that I could speak to this information that's coming regarding the legal issue?
I would just as soon take that tomorrow when people are know that it's on the schedule.
Okay.
Certainly, if you have copies of that and would like to pass it out to the committee, we'd certainly appreciate it.
Okay.
So we can look at it before the committee tomorrow. I would appreciate that.
Yeah. The
With that, I would like to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.